Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. Welcome and please be seated.
They say Miami's usually at the eye of the storm during this sort of season, but it looks like Birmingham might be a little closer to the edge this time. We'll see how the rest of the week goes, but I'm glad to be here with my friends, Judge Newsom and Judge Brasher, and I'm sure we'll have a very, very good week here. Judge Brasher has something to say to counsel, something that we've been trying to get going to try to move some of the sittings that would otherwise be in Montgomery to Birmingham at least every once in a while. So,
yeah, so this is our second sitting in Birmingham this year, and we are just kind of doing some analysis about that. This is new for us, and so you should get, I know this is what you want to hear before your argument, you should get a survey after this argument. It would really help us if you would respond to that survey, answer the survey if you would. Hopefully you'll get it. The survey is not about the judges. It's about the facilities. And it's anonymous. So we'd appreciate it if you would respond.
You know the lighting system. When the yellow light turns on, that means that your time is starting to draw to a close. So begin to wrap up. If we take you beyond the red light, don't worry about it. Just keep going, and we'll finish the conversation at some point. Our first case today is number 22-14195, United States versus Timothy Buchanan. Mr. Bradford.
May it please the court. The memorandum that was sent to counsel presented a challenge in this case to cipher out 2X1.1 and in this case 2B1.1. 2X1.1 has to have some field of operation, otherwise it wouldn't be in the sentencing guidelines. And I think the difference is the treatment that conspirators receive under the guidelines as far as sentencing versus an individual. If we have an individual, the individual is strictly sentenced under 2B1.1, and it becomes an easier matter to calculate loss, harm, and to sentence that person. But a conspirator is treated differently altogether under the guidelines, and there's some reasons for that. And the guidelines set those reasons out starting in Chapter 1, where it differentiates actions of the individual versus joint criminal action, and set some parameters for things that we are going to hold someone accountable for versus what we aren't. And those parameters being the scope of the agreement, primarily in this case, the furtherance of the conspiracy element, and then whether it's reasonably foreseeable. 2X1.1 follows that line of thought in that it attempts to mitigate or moderate the amount of punishment a conspirator receives based upon those same considerations. And I think the question we were presented is how does that section affect the district court's decision to calculate intended loss in this case?
Yeah, so I mean, so just to put a point on this, I mean, the 2X1.1, which was the operative guideline here, says any intended offense conduct. And so, you know, given that language and that guideline, and just given the nature of the fact it's a conspiracy, you know, that guideline covers attempt, solicitation, conspiracy, inchoate offenses. Aren't we necessarily looking at intended loss in this case instead of actual loss?
Yes and no. And the reason I say that is I think what 2X1.1 instructs us to do is to look at conduct first, before we look at harm or before we look at loss. And I think that's the critical step that the district court did not do in this case.
Okay. What's the distinction? And maybe I'm just missing something. What's the distinction between offense conduct?
The way it's worded in the guideline is the intended offense conduct. And I think what it instructs us to do is we've got to determine exactly what it is that the defendant agreed to do. What was their intended conduct in this case?
But I guess to Judge Brasher's question or point, why wouldn't there be some correspondence between the intended offense conduct and the intended loss?
I think there can be in the end, but I think the conduct portion of it may limit how far we go on the loss. And that was the argument at sentencing in this case, is because of the limited scope of his agreement in this case, the loss should be limited to things that fell within that scope, his intended conduct in this case. And it's an unusual case in that there's clear evidence to limit what his intended conduct is. In any agreement, there's two sides, Mr. Buchanan in this case on one, Mr. Crawford, Ms. Robinson on the other, and both have input as to what that agreement is. Buchanan was not allowed to participate in the overall scheme, in the overall conspiracy, for the most part. He was kept away from the checks, the equipment. He was put up in a hotel separate from the other two. They would not tell him where they were. He was not involved in the input of what banks to go to, in particular the amount of the checks that were counterfeited, how much was put on the checks, how many checks, and how many checks were intended to be passed. His role was limited to taking a check, one ID, and one other form of ID, usually a credit card, into a bank, making that transaction, coming out, handing that ID back over to Mr. Crawford with the money, and receiving 10%.
But that offense can't be completely divorced from the conduct of the other two co-conspirators in doing everything they had to do to get the check ready for him to try to negotiate unlawfully at a bank, right?
I agree. But I think that speaks to the criminal liability in the case. And certainly he has criminal liability as far as the whole conspiracy. But as Chapter 1 tells us, criminal liability is not tantamount to sentencing accountability. And that's the difference. In the sentencing scheme, we have to look more at the accountability that the guidelines puts on him versus the full extent of his criminal liability. They're not always the same.
Where do you think his sentencing exposure cuts off?
We would say that it cuts off with the checks that were in the white envelope, which were in the interior of the car, versus the checks in the trunk, which were in the black lockbox, that the only person that had access to those checks was Mr. Crawford. And that would limit his exposure to around $18,000.
And what's the basis for that? I mean, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I thought that the checks that were in the, maybe you get this confused, but wasn't the plan to cash all the checks?
Possibly. Okay. I think the plan for the trip to Mobile certainly involved the checks that had been produced and put in the white envelope with the IDs that corresponded to them. Right. And I think it's fair to say that he had some knowledge of those checks. I think the evidence was that there was only one attempt to cash or pass a check in Mobile. He got spooked. He left the bank, and it never came to fruition. But those checks were the checks that were actively in play as far as this trip to Mobile. I can't say the same, and I don't think the evidence shows that the same can be said for the checks in the black lockbox and the other equipment that Buchanan didn't have access to or didn't use.
But so maybe I'm missing something, but if the language of the guideline, 2X1.1, is intended offense conduct, I mean, to Judge Brasher's question, what weren't the ones in the lockbox part of the overall plan, intent?
I think it's fair to say that the overall conspiracy was to cash and pass some or all of the checks involved in total.
It just seems difficult then to figure out, Judge Jordan was asking you, where you draw the line. It seems, if you're acknowledging that, yeah, part of the plan was at least to pass some of those that were in the lockbox, I don't know how we draw the line at the lockbox itself, and if in fact at least some of them were part of the plan, part of the intent.
I think we would draw that line by looking at what his agreement was, the scope of his agreement, which is limited by what he was allowed to do or not do in the conspiracy. The checks were actually produced and counterfeited by Crawford at a different location using equipment that only he had access to. He was the only one that had the password to the computer. He owned the machine to imprint. He owned and procured the blank checks, the printer. Mr. Buchanan was never in a position to use that equipment or know exactly what they were doing with that equipment, what they chose to pick out as the checks to be counterfeited. So his involvement is limited by the actual behavior of the conspirators in this case.
Can I ask you, just in the time you've got left, to address an issue that I'd like to explore with your adversary a little bit, the sophisticated means enhancement?
Yes, sir.
Can you just describe to me what you understand the sophisticated means to have been?
I'm sorry, repeat.
What's the basis for the enhancement? The sophisticated means were, in fill in the blank.
I think the theory is the sophisticated means in this case is you had to have a piece of special equipment to imprint the checks. You had to have special software to print these counterfeit checks. It's a pretty involved process.
I mean, of your client.
It didn't always work.
I guess I mean of your client. Is the sophisticated means putting super glue on your fingers?
I don't think so. I think his involvement is very simple. The task that he had was very simple. It was not sophisticated. It was to walk into a bank and cash a check. And I think that's why we argued that point is there is some sophistication in this whole scheme, but it's not any sophisticated things that he did. It's the other conspirators. His activity and the scope of his agreement and his task in the case were very simple. He thwarted the getting a thumbprint by putting super glue on his fingers. That's not very particularly sophisticated. Or going into a bank and showing an ID and cashing a check. The sophisticated end was the production of the checks, and that's something he did not have any part in. I think the evidence was undisputed that he didn't have a part in that.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Gray.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court. Scott Gray on behalf of the United States of America. This court should affirm Timothy Buchanan's sentence because the district court properly accounted for his culpability in the scheme at sentencing. And while I'm happy to go wherever the court wishes to take me, I will start with the actual versus intended loss issue and the interpretation of both 2B1.1 and the helper provisions in the guidelines, namely the relevant conduct in 1B1.3, as well as the general conspiracy guideline in 2X1.1. And there are a couple of sort of factual nuances about this scheme. And the first thing I would point the court to is the actual analysis that the district court did, because it's sentencing. The district court selected a middle ground between the loss the United States sought and the loss that Buchanan sought. And that analysis is in the sentencing transcript. It's docket entry 188 on pages 11 to 13. And the way this scheme worked is there were stolen real checks. And I believe those were the checks in the lockbox. There were several dozen of them. But then they also had blank check paper, which they would then use to create counterfeit checks from those stolen checks. And what the district judge did is looked and said, I believe there were 286 blank checks in that vehicle. And the district court concluded that of those, they might be able to actually produce 100 bona fide counterfeit checks that might pass muster, because there was some evidence in the record that on at least some occasions they messed it up. And so the check, once it was actually produced, wasn't a compelling counterfeit. And then the district court looked at the average amounts. And those tended to skew anywhere from $1,000 a check to $4,000 a check. And so the district court said, if you produced 100 checks at $2,500 a pop, that creates a loss of $250,000. And the United States submits for purposes of appeal that that is a relatively conservative estimate that would suffice under either 2B1.1 directly, under 2X1.1's estimate of reasonable certainty, or under any of the standards applicable in the guidelines. The other note factually that I would point out in the record is that there has been some discussion today about the defendant's role. And the United States respectfully submits that the defendant was a necessary conduit in this scheme. He was the person who ultimately was the conduit between his co-conspirators and the bank teller. He was the person who relied on his knowledge as a serial fraudster to decide whether he was going to have a realistic chance of cashing this check in the bank or whether he was going to fall short. And so the United States submits that the loss estimate that the district court calculated readily suffices for purposes of his culpability.
Can you just address the First Circuit decision that says we don't have to get into this question if it's a conspiracy? I mean, the way I understand the First Circuit's decision is, look, it's a conspiracy, it's an inchoate offense, you're under 2X1.1, so you don't have to get into this question about whether the substantive guideline, when it says loss, means actual loss or intended loss. It's a conspiracy, so you just look at the intended offense conduct.
Yes, Your Honor. 2X1.1 directly speaks to intended loss for conspiracy offenses. There was a bank fraud conspiracy conviction in this case, and therefore you can ultimately look to the intended loss that is estimatable with reasonable certainty, and then for the reasons noted in the record of the district court's estimate, that readily suffices under the standard. So this court ultimately doesn't have to engage that question directly. If it did engage that question directly, the United States submits that it has strong arguments based on the text of the guideline and another attendant supporting guideline, namely the relevant conduct guideline in 1B1.3. And I'm certainly happy to delve into that, but I don't have to. I will touch on, I know was Judge Newsom.
Was there a 2X1.1 calculation conducted by the probation office in the district court?
My recollection of the pre-sentence report is that there is a reference to 2X1.1 in the PSI, more or less as the pass-through. I don't think that when you got to the loss at sentencing, the parties were speaking in 2X1.1 language directly. I don't want to overstate what the record will show, but I do believe that when the court looks at that analysis on pages 11 to 13, the district court's conservative estimate of the intended loss, accounting for a generous margin of error, readily would suffice under the reasonable certainty standard because the district court was very careful in its analysis to account for potential factors that would have led to some failures on their part. It didn't simply do a rote, there's going to be a 100% success rate in this scheme calculation, which could have potentially created some challenges for me on appeal. But I think that the ultimate estimate in the record is a reasonable one, and that that's ultimately one the court can rely on and affirm. I know Judge Newsom had asked my opponent, but then by way of indicating that I should be prepared.
It was really to you.
I think your opponent, Judge Newsom's question was, what in the record supports the sophisticated means enhancement? And I think your opponent's answer should have been nothing in the record supports the sophisticated means enhancement. What do you think about that?
So I think there are a couple of ways of looking at the sophisticated means. And I will note that the approach that I took in the brief was to say there were sophisticated elements of this scheme that the defendant participated in because when he went into the bank, he relied on his knowledge and experience as a recidivist fraudster who had committed this type of scheme in the past to assess that situation. He had.
Does that mean that every recidivist fraudster is a sophisticated participant in subsequent frauds?
I don't think that it means exactly that, but this defendant had engaged in this type of conduct, and it wasn't just one occasion. My recollection is there were a series of circumstances where this defendant had engaged in this type of activity, and he took special steps to protect himself, namely coating his fingers in super glue.
That seems like the only thing that it looks like to me, and I want you to respond to this. I mean, it looks like what the district court did here is say, look, this was a sophisticated scheme overall, and he participated in the scheme, therefore sophisticated means. The problem, and it looks like that is inconsistent with the guideline and our precedent, which says you have to look at his individual conduct. What do you say about that?
So, yes, Your Honor, that's exactly where I was going to go second. And the way I read the district court statement is it's a little bit different when I look back at it, because there's language in the guideline, and I don't have it in front of me, that talks about whether the defendant caused the execution, basically, of the sophisticated elements. And Judge DuBose's reasoning, as I understood it, was that he caused the execution of those sophisticated elements of the scheme because he ultimately was the necessary end component of the of the scheme. He was
so anyone who is a but-for participant in a sophisticated scheme is a sophisticated means enhancee.
I'm reluctant to go that far, but where this person was the necessary component in every single check that would be cashed, I think it might be a different question if you had a series of individuals, any one of whom could have been asked at any time to go into a bank.
Gosh, I just don't know if that's the word cause there is. I mean, he came in after. So, you know, I guess I could understand that reasoning if he did something at the beginning that then spawned in some kind of like historical, you know, way the sophisticated means to happen. But here, the sophisticated means of this scheme comes in and taking the checks and creating the fake IDs and all that kind of stuff. And then he comes in at the end, right? So how does he cause something if, as a matter of pure timeline, he's at the end and not the beginning?
I think as a factual matter, he's not exactly coming in at the end. I mean, he is a vigorous participant. He goes on multiple trips. He's alongside these people. I don't want to suggest that he's alongside them when they actually create the checks, because I don't think that's what the record supports. But he is absolutely an eager participant in all of the aspects of the scheme. He explains at the beginning of the trial, docket entry 191, page 82, that he knows exactly how this type of scheme works. So he's very well aware, based on his history, of how this is going to get to the point where he's walking into a bank with a check. So I do believe that there's enough room here, once again accounting for the lower bar that one has to clear at sentencing, which it is just a preponderance of the evidence. This also is a factual conclusion of the district court, so it's reviewable for clear error, that there is ultimately enough here on the body of the record as a whole for the court to ultimately affirm that conclusion. I recognize.
Let me just ask you this. If someone putting super glue on his fingers at the end of a fraud to consummate the fraud, if that's sophisticated means, what participation in a fraud isn't? I mean, is there any limitation to this theory? That's what I wonder.
I think the limitation in this theory is asking why. Why did the defendant do this type of activity? And I think that that's what's borne out in this court's case law on sophisticated means, which looks at why is the defendant taking this action? Is it based on a specialized body of knowledge that is within the province of the defendant? And that's not to say that every single time someone has committed some sort of fraud in the past, that background knowledge in and of itself constitutes sophisticated means, but that when you have someone who is a serial recidivist, who is engaged in this type of activity, who at every turn indicates that he knows exactly how this scheme is going to work, that when he participates and he agrees to be the sole conduit who's going to be going into the banks and actually passing the checks, which I would submit is the most difficult component of this scheme, coming face to face with the bank teller.
It might be difficult, but is it sophisticated? It doesn't seem to me particularly sophisticated. It might be gutsy.
It's bold, but it is sophisticated when he is relying on his repository of knowledge to size up that situation. He is the most vulnerable link to them being exposed and caught.
I mean, the example in the commentary is hiding assets or transactions through the use of fictitious entities, corporate shells, or offshore financial accounts. I mean, this just seems so unsophisticated in comparison to what the commentary is suggesting is actually sophisticated means.
If you're a former bank security officer and you know from having worked at a branch exactly what the vulnerable points are during the day for a robbery to take place, and then you decide, I'm going to turn to a different life and I'm going to try to rob money from a bank and I'm going to exploit those vulnerable times during the day, is that sophisticated means?
I think, Your Honor, in the case of the bank employee, the person with that type of specialized knowledge, yes, that is sophisticated means.
Really?
And
what fraud is not sophisticated under that view of the enhancement?
What successful fraud is not sophisticated?
Yeah. I mean, every fraud, by definition, involves deceptive conduct. A con, a way for you to get someone's attention and then trust and then betray that trust in one way, shape, or form. What is not sophisticated if the former bank security officer, I mean bank security guard, if he's using sophisticated means, who is not using sophisticated means?
I think the example is someone who is committing a fraud scheme without a deep background of knowledge. I mean, someone, for example, who looks up on Google how to pass a check and then
A first timer, a second timer,
someone with a long gap in criminal history. So, for example, someone who
See, you're focusing on, and maybe you're right, but you're focusing on the defendant's characteristics and not whether the offense has conduct that is sophisticated. It used to be a relatively easy determination before 2015 because it was just offense-based. If the offense involves sophisticated means and you were part of the offense, you got tagged with the enhancement. But ever since 2015, you've got the defendant-specific component. And I think what we're all trying to figure out in different ways is how do you differentiate a run-of-the-mill fraud from one that triggers this enhancement?
I understand that, Your Honor, and I absolutely am not going to suggest that this defendant is at the high end of the sophisticated means spectrum. This is not a complex financial fraud scheme that involves the nuances of lying to the SEC and things like that. But I submit that, Your Honor, where you're looking at how to resolve that question, the court ultimately should give ample latitude to district courts to make that decision as a factual question in the first instance. And ultimately here, I am willing to acknowledge certainly that this is a marginal case. It is a case that is close to the line. But ultimately, when the court is confronted with a case that is close to a line under a standard like clear error, I respectfully submit that the court should defer to the district court's judgment because the district court sat through the trial and listened to the testimony and was able to consider all of those factors ultimately at sentencing and make that decision. And that this case, even if it's close, even if it's marginal and borderline, falls within the realm of discretion that is available to a district judge for purposes of sentencing. And therefore, for that reason, the United States respectfully submits that this court should affirm Buchanan's convictions and his sentence. And unless the court has further questions, I will yield the 15 seconds I have left and thank the court for its time this morning.
All right. Thank you very
much.
Thank
you.
Let me start with the sophisticated means. Can I change my answer and say nothing? Because that really is the truthful answer. I think the problem that we get into is the government's argument ignores the agreement in this case, the scope of his agreement. This scheme was already in place. Crawford and Robinson had already done this scheme in Flowood, Mississippi, before they ever met Mr. Buchanan. They had the equipment, they had the blank checks, they had the copier, they had the computer, they had the special machine that imprints the checks.
The problem, Mr. Bradford, is you keep going to this agreement, but the agreement continues. See, I think personally that you would have a strong argument on the agreement scope if this was a one-time shot. And so if he met them after they had all the equipment, they had stolen the checks, they had created the fraudulent new ones, and then as a one-off, they gave him 10 checks and he went to cash them all. Okay, I understand where you're coming from. But this thing continued, and he knew what was at stake, and he knew how they were producing the checks. I think he's all in. That doesn't mean that he used sophisticated means. I get that, but...
Well, I think that goes with an assumption that he would continue in the scheme.
But he did. He never stopped, and they arrested him while the three of them were getting ready to do it again.
Well, I think that's where 2X1.1 comes in, because we have to look at what he intended, and there's no guarantee that check that he tried to cash in Mobile would be his last check. I mean, they met this gentleman while he was riding a bicycle on Tampa streets, and they recruited him because he resembled someone in an ID they had. So his position in that conspiracy is fairly tenuous. They didn't need him particularly. They'd done the scheme before with other people, other IDs. So, you know, his intention, I guess, was to ride it out if he could, but that becomes an issue of whether it's speculative, whether he would ever have participated in cashing the remainder of those checks. And I think 2X1.1 says that we have to be very, very exacting in trying to determine exactly what conduct was specifically intended. And in his case, it's limited. But I do agree on the sophisticated means. I don't think what he did was sophisticated. I think the amendment in 2015 was specifically designed in part to eliminate this but-for test and to focus more on the element of an individual defendant's participation. And did they actually participate in the sophisticated aspect of this case? And I would suggest the sophisticated aspect of the case is coming up with the scheme, obtaining the equipment, and actually producing the counterfeit checks. That's the more sophisticated end. Gutsy, I agree, to walk into a bank and to cash a check, but that's not sophisticated. It happens every day, countless times. So I don't think the sophisticated means enhancement should have been applied. The last thing I would say is I think we can't lose sight of Chapter 1's admonition that sentencing accountability is different from criminal liability. And a lot of the things we've talked about is he liable for all the conduct of the conspiracy? And I think criminal liability-wise, sure, yes. I mean, that's the nature of federal conspiracy law. But when we come down to sentencing, we're concerned with the individual, what they intended and what they actually did. And that's not always the same. In this case, Mr. Buchanan's sentencing accountability is less than his criminal liability. And I think that's the point that the district court overlooked.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Bradford. Thank you both.